Well, good morning, everyone. If you didn't get a copy of the handout, Dan has them there. You can raise your hand and he can get you a copy. I'm glad to be here together with you. I'm excited to look at the scriptures together. This is one of the lessons where I'm going to ask for your help, preferably after the lesson is done, not during the middle of it, and help me come up with a better sermon title. I've talked about how I always feel like I don't have a good idea for what the sermon title ought to be. But it just the question, can life have worth? I'm going with the idea of worth rather than meaning, because we're going to be reading from Ecclesiastes, and it talks about the vanity or the emptiness, and so I think worth is a good word for that. Can life have worth? Does our life have any meaning at all? These kind of big questions that we can bump into at times. If we believe in God, then we can most often have a decent answer ready and we're able to move past it. If we don't believe in God, we might have to struggle with that more. But even just because we have faith doesn't mean that these questions don't stress us out or cause frustrations in our lives. There's a lot of people in the Bible who struggle with these sorts of things. Isaiah 40, starting in verse 6, says, "All flesh is as grass, and its beauty like the flower of the field. The grass withers. The flower fades when the breath of the Lord blows on it. Surely people are grass. The grass withers. The flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever." It's not the most uplifting set of verses there. That last line is where there is hope, but the reality is, do you feel that way sometimes, that you feel like we're just grass and we're all just fading away? What was your drive to church like this morning? Did you see all of the beautiful fields just full of green growth and harvest and, you know, bright, cheery apples and cherries? And no, it's all death out there right now. This is the cycle that we go through. It's supposed to look this way. And you look out, and all the trees are bare, and they're naked, and all the fields have been plowed and torn over, and there's stubble left. It's not fruitful right now. And you look out, and you realize that, wow, we're just grass, and summer was great, but winter's here, and we all just kind of move into rough times. One of my favorite songs, "Abide With Me," "Change and decay in all around I see." That's a really dire line. But we look out and we see change and we see decay. And the reality is that there's a lot that can be very depressing or frustrating in life. I want to look through Ecclesiastes, and we're not going to study the whole book of Ecclesiastes this morning. But we're going to do a survey and look at least one line from each book and just really, I mean, the end result is really depress ourselves. That's kind of what the point of this is going to be. As I'm reading through Ecclesiastes, I'm actually not even including the positive answers that the book itself does provide. There are positive answers. I might mention a couple, but I'm pulling out just some of the harsh realities. What did Solomon do, this great preacher and this wise man of God? He tried to use his wisdom to understand everything, right? He's going to try to figure it all out. And it is written by Solomon, a man who knew God and knew a lot about God and understood God. Even so, it's written in a way that the book can relate to a world that does not know God. I think an unbeliever can appreciate the book of Ecclesiastes very well. And if you read through the book of Ecclesiastes, thinking in your mind, what is life without God? The book of Ecclesiastes is trying to say, this is what it's like. This is what's out there. And even with God, this is what it's like. And this is what's out there. And so I think that there's a lot that our friends and neighbors can gain from, or at least when they're reading through the book of Ecclesiastes, it might not put a big grin on their mouth. But they're going to say, yeah, I know exactly what that's talking about. So the preacher, Solomon, he applied to understand, he tried to figure out, and that last line there in verse 14, it is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. That's one of his thoughts, and that's not a bright, cheerful idea. And there's this idea about vanity, vanity of vanities, this Hebrew word that talks about mist or breath, something that you can't grab onto. It shows up over and over and over again in this book. The author's trying to say that when we try to look and do and understand and work at it, it's all just grabbing at the wind. All right, so let's just look through. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on chapter 2 just to get the momentum going. In chapter 2, verse 1, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this is also vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what is the use of it? I search with my heart to know how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what good for the children of man, what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. And then just jump down to verse 10. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was the reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil that I had expended doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So I'm going to try to do what makes me happy. Talk about our society today. The point of living is feeling good. The point of living is having happiness. And he did it. And he did all these different things that he could. And he said, you know what? It still ended up pretty pointless. We live in a society that says the ultimate good is, you know, the pursuit of happiness. And our society still pumps out movies where the main characters try to get rich and try to have happiness and try to have pleasures. And even in our movies, we find out that that's not the way that things should go. Right? It's just the reality that we live in. Look at verses 13 through 15. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. And then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. Is it better to be a fool or is it better to be wise? Well, it's better to be wise. You're going to walk with your eyes open in your head. And then, like the fool, you'll die. So then what's the use? Like, even when we find something that's good in life, what's the use? It seems like it can end up being a mess. Verse 17 is one of my favorites because it is one of the most depressing verses in all of Scripture. So I hated life because what was done under the sun was grievous to me, and all is vanity and a striving after the wind. It doesn't get much worse than that. Everything was grievous to him. Verses 18 and 19. I hated all my toil in which I toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to another man who will come after me, and who knows whether he'll be wise or a fool. Why even have a job and make all this money? Because I'm going to leave it to my kids, and boy, they're a mess. And I mean it literally, guys. No. I can do all these things, and it's a good thing to do. And then I pass it on. And honestly, this is just the way that the rest of the book goes. We can try to move quickly. Chapter 3, verse 16. I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, even there is wickedness. And in the place of righteousness, even there is wickedness. We go to our law courts to find justice. And do we find justice in the seat of justice? We don't always find it there. And that's a mess, and that's depressing. Look at chapter 3, verses 20 and 21. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and to dust all return. And who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down to the earth. But I do think I do know that the spirit of man does go up to God. And I think that Solomon knows that, but he's expressing, are we better off than the animals? We're all just going to turn into dust in the end. And if you don't know God, then this is a really dark, complicated, frustrating thought. Chapter 4, and again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun. And behold, the tears of the oppressed, that they had no one to comfort them. And on the side of their oppressors, there was power. Do you know people? Or have you experienced being under the oppression of another? Someone who abused you or took advantage of you in your home or at your work. This is our world. Chapter 5. There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Verse 13. Riches were kept by their owner to his own hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture, and he is a father of his son, but he has nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again. Naked as he came, he shall take nothing for all of his toil that he carried away in his hand. Back in chapter 2, we're leaving it to a fool of a son. Well, in this one, if we don't have a fool of a son, it turns out that we don't have anything to leave in the end anyways. And so we're just spinning and spinning in this. I mean, this is a rough book, right? Let's go to chapter 6. Chapter 6, verse 10. Whatever has come to be has already been named. And it is known what man, and it is known what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The more words, the more vanity, and what is the advantage to man? For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? I mean, we can do a pretty decent job trying to find a little bit of meaning in our individual days. Well, I'm going to wake up and I'm going to go to work, and work is good, and eating my food is good. That's one of the conclusions that the author of Ecclesiastes comes to. But this is talking about the bigger questions and thinking about what's the point, and the author gets a little bit stressed out about that. The very end of chapter 7, God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. God made us to be good, and what have we done instead? Well, I know God's law, but what if I try this, and what if I just put these things together, and what if I try to wheedle out of this idea? God made me for good, and what have I been doing with so much of my life? Well, what about an evil person? 8:14. There are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked, and there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. Good people get bad things. Bad people get good things. That complaint shows up in the Psalms. It shows up in the Ecclesiastes. It shows up in the Bible. You look out in the world, you're like, I'm trying to be good, and I'm getting bad stuff, and I'm looking at the wicked people, and they're having the good things. These are real questions. I think people in the world understand them. What about if you get really good at something? What if you practice? What if you become really skilled in your labor, in your work, or in your activities? Chapter 9, verse 11. And I saw that under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor the bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge, but time and chance happen to them all. But I tried really hard, and I got really prepared, and I did what I needed to do. Yeah, and then a hurricane showed up, or some sort of circumstance. Now, ironically, we like verse 11. Otherwise, no one would ever watch sports, right? You think about all the racing sports. If somebody has a faster car, then they win. Why watch the race? If somebody is a faster runner, then they're going to win. There's no competition. We actually like the fact that maybe the underdog or that things change. But in verse 11, it's written in the sense of it's kind of like we're spinning our wheels and we're not getting anything done. Chapter 10, verses 5 through 7. Error proceeding from the ruler, folly is set up in the high place and the rich in the low place, slaves on the horses and princes on the ground. The world is upside down. It's not acting the way it ought, not the way I think it ought to be. Chapter 11, verse 8. So if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all, but let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. All that comes is vanity. Live a good life, the preacher is saying. Enjoy your days, because the days after it's going to be longer. Enjoy the light, because the night will be longer. That's a perspective that we get in this world. And then I think everybody loves chapter 12, verse 12. My son, beware of anything beyond these. He said a good, wise statement. Follow the wise statements of verse that he mentions in verse 11. But beyond these, beware of anything beyond these. Of making of many books, there is no end. And much study is a weariness of the flesh. This one's depressing, but really in a fun kind of way. Like, oh, they're always going to be writing books, and they're always going to be getting smarter and smarter, and it's never going to end, which kind of means that they're actually not getting smarter, and what are we going to do? That's kind of a fun one. But this pursuit to have the end of all things and the knowledge and the answer of all things, and more books are going to be written. And now with the internet and self-publishing and the crazy blogs out there, the books are getting wilder. And so we're looking at this. And again, I have passed over some of the answers. I'm going to look at those in a minute. But the author is trying to say, what's going on? And I have friends I'm not saying that they're walking around sobbing and hysterical in their sorrow and pointlessness of life, but they acknowledge the pointlessness of life. They look around and say, bad things are happening to good people, or there's in the seat of justice, there is no justice, or I've made all this money, now what? And that's a reality. Humans on this earth, isn't it interesting that God gives us this perspective from himself? He says this. And one of the big questions is, well, then where is God in all of this? Because one of the things that you can say, if you have a strong faith in God and a good understanding in God, every time you run across one of these complaints or difficulties, you can say, yes, but God. And that's really the answer. Yes, but God. And then you can finish the sentence that with God there is more, and with God there is life. But that's kind of the point of this book. What if there is no God? Or what if you're struggling in your understanding of God or in your faith in God and your trust in God? That's one of the big things in this book. Well, in chapter 12, the very end, I mean, this is the oversimplified answer. I hate to read just this answer, but it does sum up the book very well. Verses 13 and 14 of chapter 12, the end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man, for God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. There's a lot about the judgment that's going to happen to all of mankind in 11 and in 12. And there is a sense of, if there are good things to do, you do those good things, just know that God is going to judge you. And if I know that that's in the background, then the futility in life can be okay, because there's God who is a judge and he's going to make things better than the futility. Or if there's this futility in life and I'm just living it up, I might as well be drunk every moment of the day, I'm going to be called in for that as well. And so that is one of the answers. It's the major answer that he provides. But turn back to chapter 3. I really want to take the time to look at this answer as well. Again, I'm going through the book of Ecclesiastes way too quickly, and I'm only talking about the depressing parts, kind of on purpose. You know, it's a two-part sermon, and the first part is depression, right? That's. But look at what he offers us in chapter 3, verses 9 through 15. Now, the first 8 verses, you might recognize that as a beautiful poem. It turned into a neat song a few years ago. But look at verse 9. What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He's made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to end. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is the gift. This is God's gift to man. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. That which is already has been. That which is to be already has been. And God seeks what has been driven away. Here is a strong grounding. God is a solid rock here. This is a foundation, something that we can hold on to. Now, there's a little bit of futility in it. What's the greatness of life? Eat, drink, and go to work. It's not eat, drink, and be merry, right? It's eat, drink, and work, which is an interesting total change from the idea of eat, drink, and be merry. But also, God has made everything beautiful, verse 11, but it's in its time. Not in my time or my timetable. God has put eternity into our heart, verse 11. And we can start discussing all the myriad of things that that can mean. But God has put eternity into our heart, but that doesn't mean that we're going to know the beginning to the end. But God has given us these things. There is beauty. He's given us eternity. I like to think of he's given us a soul, this eternal aspect to ourselves. Not that I'm going to figure out everything from the beginning to the end, but he's given us access, he's given us insight, he's given us these opportunities to know, so that when we are bumping into the depressing realities of life is hard, and he gave us 10 toes so that we can balance, but also 10 toes to stub against that chair in the darkness. So are we going to be grateful for what God has given us, or frustrated for what God has given us? The book of Ecclesiastes is that way. It's a complicated and interesting book. So how many unbelievers can read this and recognize the futility? And then maybe recognize why, though they are an unbeliever, they can see why belief in God has value to us and why we appreciate it. Because we're living through sorrow as they're living through sorrow, but we're trying to see what beauty and eternity has been given into our hearts to survive through it. Without God, it's a pretty futile and vain life. Even Solomon, who knew God, was saying it's a pretty futile and vain life. There's the great joke, the only thing that you can really depend upon is death and taxes, right? That's kind of what this book is trying to say. So what are we going to think about past death? Two of our songs this morning were really good. Faith is the victory, and I know that my Redeemer lives. When we were singing through those, I was thinking about the mud that we were going to have to wade through in the first half of this lesson. Also in Psalm 118, for his steadfast love, or for his mercy, endures forever. We might be born in mud and live in mud, but his steadfast love, his mercy is going to pull us out of that mud. Those are big things that we can think about. All right, now I want to look at the book of Isaiah and just think about Isaiah. We'll be reading chapter 40 in a little bit if you want to look at that and turn to that. Somebody had pointed out in a lesson I heard last week, and I'd never thought of this before, just how the book of Isaiah is like a microcosm or a mini version of the whole Bible. One oversimplification of the book of Isaiah, but I think it's applied every time I read through, I think that this is a great description. God says in this book, do you trust me? Here is the law, do you trust me? Here are the consequences, do you trust me? Here's what you can do to survive, do you trust me? Here's what's going to happen in the future, do you trust me? Over and over and over again, God is opening up to his people, do you trust me? And in a lot of ways, that's what the Bible says. Here is the answers, here's what the history is, here's what the future is, and the Bible is asking us if we trust God or not. But then you can also look at the way that the book is structured. And I think that this might be a lot of, I don't think this is divine intervention here. But there's 66 books in the Bible, and there's 66 chapters in the book of Isaiah, and I just think that that's pretty cool. I knew about that connection, but if you divide the book of Isaiah in half, the division happens right at chapter 40 where we're going to read. And this is a universally understood idea, that the book of Isaiah has two parts. Part 1 is 1 to 39, and part 2 is 40 through 66. It's so much so that skeptics say somebody else started writing the second half of the book. They don't even think Isaiah wrote it because his manner and his tone changes. But you can see the thread. It's the same man through. It's almost like he's writing Bible classes and he's writing sermons. They're going to be spoken in a different way. And I think that's all that's happening there in Isaiah. And so the first 39 books are the Old Testament. And it just works out that the first half of Isaiah is 39 chapters, and that's just really cool. And so then the math works out. The New Testament has 27 chapters, and the part 2 of Isaiah has 27 chapters. I just thought that that was really neat. So what that means is, in the first half of the Bible and the first half of Isaiah, their themes are going to be somewhat similar, right? What is the Old Testament about, if you're going to summarize it? It's God. It's about God. I mean, God is the main character in the whole Old Testament. His law, his words, his judgments, how he provides for the people, but he has demands of the people. I am giving you this. You need to do this. That's what the first half of Isaiah is all about. Law and the consequences. Have they been doing? Have they not been doing? This is what you need to step up and do. What is the New Testament about? Well, again, God's the main character as well, but it's Jesus, it's this Messiah, it is the Savior who comes, and it's about the kingdom that he establishes, and the redemption, and the reconciliation, and the righteousness, and all those great big key words. And that's what the New Testament is about, and that's what the second half of Isaiah is about. He moves from the laws and the sermons about how they were a mess into the messages and the prophecies about the one who is coming and what he's going to establish. And so the Old Testament and the first half of Isaiah and the New Testament and the second half of Isaiah, it's not perfect, But it's really special that way. And so that means if you start reading in Isaiah chapter 40, it's a lot like reading Matthew 1 or Mark 1 or Luke 1 or John 1, right? Because it's the gospel. It's the beginning of the new section. It's the beginning of that new idea. It's the gospel message. And so let's look at Isaiah 40. Let's read the gospel, right? The beginning of the New Testament, you know, as it kind of lines up with the book of Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 40. Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that her warfare is ended and that her iniquity is pardoned. And she that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. A voice cries in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be lifted up, every mountain hill be made low. The uneven ground shall become level and the rough area places a plain. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken. A voice says, cry. And I said, what shall I cry? All flesh is grass, and all its beauty is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades when the breath of the Lord blows on it. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever. And so this is the introduction of the gospel. This is the good news that we're receiving here. If you look down at verse 9, the good news shows up twice. So it's very much this idea of the good news. And what does it begin with? It begins with comfort. Man, that's small. I guess you guys can read it. It begins with comfort. This is exactly what we need. We've been reading Ecclesiastes for crying out loud. Or we've been living it. Right? Whether we knew God or not, we've been living it. We've been living that futile life. It's vain. And we are either spinning our wheels in the mud of this pointless life, or we've recognized God, we've appreciated his laws, and then got enslaved to sin anyways. And so what do we need? We need comfort. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that her warfare is ended. Her iniquity is pardoned. She received double from the hand of the Lord from all her sins. They were punished. They were hurt. And this is the beginning of the prophecies of the people coming back from the land out of exile. This is talking about us as well, coming back from this life of enslavement. God is offering us comfort. God is tender and comforting with his words. He's saying that our warfare and hardship has ended. Our iniquity has been pardoned. God is doing all of this. We received double. We received punishment. But God is there for us. And then we have in verses 3 through 5, a voice cries in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. The voice cries out in the wilderness, preparing the way for God. This voice is going to make a highway, a smooth way so that God can come and that people can come to God. And whenever he bumps into a mountain, he's going to knock down the mountain. And whenever he comes into a valley, he's going to fill up the valley so it's level and flat. I mean, this is what we do with our highways. They used to go around the mountains, and now we just blast our way through, right? Every valley shall be lifted up, and every mountain shall be made low, and the uneven ground level. Verse 5, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. This is John the Baptist. If you look at Luke chapter 3, this is exactly the description of John the Baptist. And it goes right back to this passage saying that John the Baptist came because comfort is here for the people, and he's knocking everything down and filling everything up so that there's this straight, easy, clear path to God so that God's glory is revealed. What does it mean that the glory of God is revealed? Well, quite literally, Jesus showed up. But the glory being revealed, the majesty that is due unto God, the revelation of God, the demonstration of his power. Think of all that Jesus did and all that God did through Jesus and with the Spirit to reveal the glory of God. John chapter 1 talks about the glory being revealed. And then we have verse 6, which is really where we started the lesson this morning. This is what the cry out is. All flesh is grass. All its beauty is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades when the breath of the Lord blows on it. Surely the people are grass. the grass withers and the flower fades. That's, I thought this was the gospel. I thought this was the good news. You're saying that we're all going to die? We know that. That's our complaint. That's the book of Ecclesiastes. That's the Old Testament revealing us we're trying to do good and we're always failing. God's given us to be good and we're always coming up with schemes. The grass withers and the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever. And that's what the good news is. Now, more is going to be revealed. But this is the good news. God's breath. What does it do in Genesis 2? It gives life. What can God's breath do in Isaiah 40? It can remove life. God is large and solid, and we're feeling depressed and hopeless and powerless, and we feel like we are fading. But the word of our God will stand forever. This is the good news. Despite the pointlessness of our own flesh, we're trying to make it work, and we don't. We're trying to be good, and we fail. God endures past the vanity that we see. Now, I don't have time to do the rest of the chapter. We're going to read 9 through 11, and then we will read 27 through 31. But you can read the whole chapter for yourself. 9 through 11, part of this good news now. Go on up a high mountain, O Zion, herald of good news. Lift up your voice with strength, O Jerusalem, herald of good news. Lift it up, fear not. Say to the cities of Judah, behold your God. Behold, the Lord God comes with might, and his arm rules for him. Behold, his reward is with him, and his recompense before him. He will tend his flock like a shepherd. He will gather his lambs in his arms. He will carry them in his bosom, and gently lead those that are with young. Look at your God, cry out and herald the good news about this God. God comes with might, God comes with his reward, and he comes with his recompense. And I looked up reward and recompense because it shows up different in some translations. He's coming with his reward, which is his hire, his wages, his reward, and his pay. And he's coming with his recompense, which is his work and his recompense and his reward. So synonyms here. He's coming with this labor and the reward for the labor. He is coming with this, and he is going to shepherd us. And look at the way he shepherds us in verse 11. He's tending, he's gathering, he's carrying, he is leading with gentleness. God is able to overcome the very vanity that we are struggling with. And we're just dumb sheep. And all we like sheep have gone astray, everyone to his own way. But God comes and shepherds us. Jump down to verse 27 now. Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my right is disregarded by my God? I'm going to stop there. I don't know what their attitude was in this statement. It might be, my way is hidden from the Lord and my right is disregarded by my God. God doesn't see me. He doesn't care about me. Or it might be, God doesn't see me. I can do whatever I want. I don't know what their attitude is. I'm thinking it might be the sad one. But there are those who think that God can't see me and it doesn't matter. The answer that he's going to provide answers both of those. The despair of thinking that God doesn't care, or maybe the hope that God doesn't see my sneakiness. Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my right is disregarded by my God? Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the faint, and to him who has no might, he increases strength. Even youths shall faint and be weary, and young men shall fall exhausted, but they who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. If you feel alone and like you're spinning your wheels, and like God isn't answering my prayers fast enough, there might be some selfishness in that, but you might be saying, God, where are you? We need to remember that he is everlasting. Look at these points, right? He doesn't get weary like we do. His understanding goes beyond what we can know. And if we are fainting, verse 29, he gives us power. If we have no might or ability to make it through a day, by reaching out to him, he feeds us the strength that we need. Strong young guys, verse 30, they get worn out. But here we are, old and weary and weak, and God's going to keep feeding us with strength. He's going to give us eagle's wings so that we can fly, and that, but we still might run anyways. And we won't get worn out. And we're not going to get bent out of shape. And when we pick up the book of Ecclesiastes and reflect on the despair that literally is out there, and some of the despair that we live through ourselves, we know what the good news is beyond that despair. And so we need to share that good news. And one of the ways that we share that good news is we don't get weary. We keep getting through. We keep having a cheerful heart. People see that. That makes one of the biggest differences in this world. And you are failing. You're failing the world when you walk around grouching and angry. We need to be better than that so that we can share the gospel with others. Let's close by looking at Psalm 119, starting in 137. There's a lot of despair out there. There's a lot of confusion. But there is so much goodness and so great a God in our lives that we're okay. Psalm 119, starting in 137. Righteous are you, O Lord, and right are your rules. You've appointed your testimonies in righteousness and in all faithfulness. My zeal consumes me because my foes forget your words. Your promise is well tried, and your servant loves it. I'm small and despised, yet I do not forget your precepts. Your righteousness is righteous forever, and your law is true. Trouble and anguish have found me out, but your commandments are my delight. Your testimonies are righteous forever. Give me understanding that I may live. If God gives us understanding, we will live. We might get sick. We might suffer loss, but we can still live because we have understanding from God. And that is what I'm hoping can be an encouragement to you today. The world is dire and the world is dark and there's problems out there. But we have the answer. And it's not trite, oh, just change your mood and everything's fine. It's not that simple. We know it's not that simple. Our Savior died in order for everything to be okay. We know it's not that simple. But let's share this message. The world knows that the world is dark. Let us help them to know the light. If you need to respond to the light, if you need to respond to God's call for you today to be saved, why don't you let us know as we stand together and sing.